Chapter 13. That had been the last time Alexei had heard the doorbell ring, as he rushed out of the back entrance of Madame Anjou's boutique, situated heaven knows where, and smelling sweetly of perfume. The bell, that meant someone had just come into the shop. Perhaps it was someone just like him, someone on his side who had got lost and had been left behind. Or perhaps it was the enemy chasing after him. Either way, to have returned to the boutique would have been impossible, an act of totally unnecessary heroism. Down some slippery steps and Alexei was outside in the yard. Here he heard with total clarity the sound of shooting coming from somewhere quite close, on the street leading down to the Kreschatik. It wasn't very likely to be coming from the museum area. He realized now that he had clearly wasted too much time wrapped in gloomy contemplation in the dimly lit shop, and that Colonel Malyshev had been absolutely right in telling him that he needed to hurry. His heart was racing with anxiety. As he looked around him, Alexei could now see that the long, endlessly high yellow building that housed Madame Anjou's was bordered by a huge yard that stretched as far as a low wall. Beyond the wall, the adjoining property belonged to the railway company. Screwing up his eyes and glancing round once again, he set off across the deserted yard, making straight for the wall. There was a gate in the wall that, to his great astonishment, was unlocked. He went through the gate and found himself in a horrible little yard with the dark slits of windows on the railway company building staring at him unpleasantly. The building was clearly lifeless. He went under the echoing archway that cut through the building and out onto the street. The hands of the ancient clock on the tower of the building opposite indicated exactly 4 o'clock. It had already begun to grow dark. The street was completely empty. Filled with foreboding, Alexei looked round apprehensively and set off down rather than up the street covered with a sprinkling of snow towards the Golden Gate, towering in the middle of the wet, slushy square. A single pedestrian in a black coat ran towards him with a frightened expression on his face and then disappeared. Empty streets in general leave a very unpleasant impression, and this one in particular gnawed away at him, filling him with a nasty premonition. Frowning angrily as he tried to make his mind up about what he should do next, he knew that he couldn't get home by flying through the air and that whatever happened he had to keep going. He raised his greatcoat collar and moved off. Then he realized partly why he was feeling so uneasy. It was the sudden absence of heavy gunfire. For the last 2 weeks it had been heard constantly, everywhere. But now the sky was quite quiet. And yet, on the other hand, somewhere down there on the Kreschatik, he could clearly hear the intermittent crackle of rifle fire. He needed to turn left, away from the Golden Gate, into that alleyway, and from there, keeping close to the St. Sophia Cathedral, quietly make his way along the back streets to St. Alexei's Hill and home. If he had done that, everything would have turned out differently. But he didn't. There is this force in life that sometimes impels you to look down from a great height into an abyss. You're drawn towards the cold, towards the steep drop. And now it was the thought of the museum that attracted him. He simply had to go and see what was happening there, even if only from a distance. And so, instead of turning off the square, he took 10 quite unnecessary steps that brought him out onto Vladimirskaya Street. But once there, the alarm bells inside him immediately started to ring, and he could distinctly hear Malyshev's voice whispering to him to run. He looked to the right, where in the distance he could see the museum. He managed to see a section of white wall and the lowering cupolas, and some black figures flitting about in the distance, but that was all he had time to see. Climbing up the steep Proreznaya Street from the Kreschatik, which was veiled in a distant frosty haze, several figures in grey greatcoats were coming straight towards him, spread across the whole width of the street. They were only about 30 yards away. Alexei could tell immediately that they had been running for a long time and that they were exhausted. Some unaccountable inner instinct, rather than his eyes, told him that they were Petlura's men. "Trapped," said Malyshev's voice distinctly from the pit of his stomach. At that point, several seconds seemed to have disappeared from Alexei's life. He had no idea what happened during this time. He came to only when he found himself round the corner on Vladimirskaya Street, his head hunched between his shoulders, his feet having carried him swiftly from the fateful corner on Prorezhnaya Street, just by the Marquis's confectionery shop. "That's right, just a bit farther," he panted, the blood coursing through his temples. Just a little bit farther without any noise from behind. If only he could turn himself into a knife blade, or simply merge into the wall. But come on! Then the silence was broken, and inevitably he heard them behind him again. "Halt!" someone shouted hoarsely at Alexei's cold retreating back. "So this is it," said the voice from the pit of his stomach. "Halt!" the voice repeated sharply. Alexei glanced round and stopped as if frozen to the spot, struck by a sudden notion that he might be able to pass himself off as a peaceful citizen. "I'm just going about my business, leave me alone," or words to that effect. From a distance of about 15 yards, his pursuer quickly raised his rifle. As soon as Alexei turned to face him, the astonishment on his face visibly increased, and it seemed to Alexei that he had slanted Mongolian eyes. A second pursuer burst round the corner and pulled back the bolt on his rifle. The expression on the first man's face changed from one of astonishment to one of malicious, unfathomable glee. "Look what we have here, Pietro! An officer!" he shouted in Ukrainian. As he said this, he looked like a hunter who had suddenly caught sight of a hare. "What? How on earth could he know that?" the thought hammered away in Alexei's brain. The second man's rifle suddenly turned into a small black hole the size of a little coin. Alexei felt himself flying like an arrow along Vladimirskaya Street, aware that his felt boots were killing him. Above and behind him came a sound like a whip cracking in the air. "Halt! Get him!" Another crack of the whip. "Get that officer!" The whole of Vladimirskaya Street resounded with the thunder of the pursuit. Two more shots zinged through the air. To transform someone's rather weak and in really difficult circumstances useless brain into the cunning instinct of a wild animal, all you need do is to chase after him with guns, and he'll turn into a cunning wolf. As Alexei rounded the corner of Maloprovalnaya Street like a hunted wolf, he caught a glimpse behind him of the black muzzle of a rifle that suddenly turned into a pale, circular ring of fire. Putting on speed, he dashed into Maloprovalnaya Street, taking a decision that changed his life for the second time in just 5 minutes. His instinct told him that if someone chases after you stubbornly and persistently enough, keeping on your tail, they will catch you, and once having caught you, they will kill you. And they would kill him, because he was running away from them, because he was carrying no papers, and because of his grey greatcoat and his revolver. And finally, they would kill him because, having missed once and then a second time, they would get him the third time. It was always the third time. That has been known since antiquity. In other words, this was the end. Another 30 seconds, and his felt boots would give up the ghost. The end was inevitable, and that being so, his fear drained away from his body and legs and into the ground. But as he ran along, he began violently spitting out the feeling of icy rage that flooded up through his legs. His eyes became slits, just like a wolf's. Two grey-coated pursuers, followed by a third, leapt round the corner of Vladimirskaya Street, all three firing at once. Gritting his teeth, Alexei slowed, and without taking aim, fired back 3 times. Again he picked up speed, dimly seeing a shadowy black figure in front of him, flitting along right next to the wall by a drainpipe. Then he suddenly felt as if someone with wooden pincers was tugging at his left armpit, making him run strangely and unevenly, a little to one side. He turned once again and loosed off 3 more shots, disciplining himself to stop at the 6th shot. "The 7th is for me. Oh, my Nikolka, my lovely golden-haired Yelena. It's all over. They'll torture me and slice the epaulets into my skin. The 7th bullet is for me." Moving along sideways, he felt a strange sensation. The revolver in his right hand was pulling his arm down on that side, but his left arm seemed somehow heavier. He needed to stop and rest. He was, in any case, totally out of breath, and he'd arrived at the end of the line. Yet he somehow managed to reach the bend in the world's most fantastic street and get round the corner out of sight, where he had a moment's respite. But farther on, it looked hopeless. All the gates were locked. That one, there, and there by that huge building, and there. The idiotic comic proverb came into his head, "Only lose hope, my friend, when you've hit rock bottom." That was when he saw her, like a miracle, by a dark, moss-covered fence in front of a line of trees fringing a garden. Half slumped against the wall, she was stretching out her arms towards him melodramatically, her enormous eyes ablaze with terror.
"Hey, officer!" she shouted. "Here, this way!"
Slipping and sliding a little in his felt boots and gulping hot air into his lungs, he staggered as quickly as he could towards the woman's outstretched arms. Drawn on by them, he practically fell through a narrow gateway in the black wooden wall. The situation was immediately transformed. The woman closed the gate, and the lock snapped shut behind her. Alexei found himself looking right into the woman's eyes. He was dimly aware of blackness and an expression of active determination.
"Come on, run, this way. Follow me," she whispered.
She turned and started running along a narrow brick path, with Alexei slowly following. To his left, he glimpsed some sheds, and then she turned again. To his right was what looked like a fairy tale white terraced garden. Then, right ahead of him, there was a low fence and another gate, through which the woman darted, with Alexei following, gasping for air. She slammed the gate shut, and Alexei caught a glimpse of a slender black-stockinged leg as she climbed agilely up some brick steps, the hem of her dress rustling. Pricking up his ears, he could hear the sounds of pursuit coming from the street behind them. Yes, there they were, just turning the corner looking for him. "She might have saved me. Might have saved me," he thought. "But I don't think I can make it. My heart." On the very last step, he suddenly fell down onto his left knee and left arm. Everything started spinning round. The woman bent down and lifted him up by his right arm.
"Just a bit farther," she urged.
With a trembling left hand, she opened a third little gate, and, dragging the stumbling Alexei through, set off again at a run along a little alleyway.
"My goodness, what a labyrinth. That's just what I need now," he thought vaguely.
And then he was in the white garden, but now much higher up and well away from that fateful Provalnaya Street. As he felt the woman dragging him along, he was aware of the heat in his left side and arm, but the rest of his body was icy cold, including his heart, which had almost stopped beating.
"She might have saved me, but this is the end, the absolute end. My legs are giving way."
Under the snow, he could dimly see some untouched virgin clumps of lilacs. Then there was a doorway and a glass lantern hanging outside an ancient snow-covered porch. He could hear the jingle of a key. Still keeping to his right-hand side, the woman used the last ounce of her strength to drag him towards the lantern. Then there was another jingle of keys, and they were in some gloomy place with a lived-in, rather musty smell. Here, above them in the gloom, a light shone very faintly, and the floor skidded sideways to the left under his feet. Green, poisonous-looking lights, rimmed with fire, flashed in front of his eyes, followed by total darkness, giving him an immediate sense of relief. A row of worn brass knobs glinting in the dim, unsteady light. There was something cold trickling down his chest, enabling him to breathe more freely, but his arm inside his left sleeve felt ominously warm and lifelessly damp.
"I'm wounded. That's what it is."
Alexei was aware that he was lying on the floor, his head pressed painfully up against something hard and uncomfortable. The brass knobs he could see in front of him clearly belonged to a trunk. The cold sensation from the water she was splashing over him was so great he could scarcely breathe.
"For God's sake, drink some of this,"
he heard a faint, chesty voice say somewhere above his head.
"Are you breathing? What do we do now?"
The glass knocked against his teeth as Alexei gulped down the icy cold water. Now that she was close to him, squatting on the floor, he could see the woman's blonde curls and dark, dark eyes. She put the glass down on the floor and, supporting him gently by the back of his head, started to lift him up.
Is my heart still beating? He wondered. I'm coming back to life, it seems. Maybe I haven't lost too much blood. I have to fight this.
Yes, his heart was beating, but unsteadily and too fast, as if it were tying itself in knots.
Use whatever you like to cut everything off if you need to, but get a tourniquet on me quickly, he said weakly.
Her eyes wide, she tried to digest what he'd just said. Then, grasping what it was he wanted her to do, she leapt up and dashed to the cupboard and started pulling out heaps of material. Biting his lip, Alexei thought,
There's not much sign of blood on the floor. With any luck, I've not lost too much.
As he twisted and turned, she helped him take his greatcoat off. Then he sat up, trying to ignore his dizziness. She began to take off his jacket.
Scissors, he said.
He found it difficult to talk as he was short of breath. With a swish of her black silk skirt, the woman went off towards the doorway, where she took off her cap and fur coat. Then she came back and squatted down beside him again. With the scissors, she cut clumsily and painfully into his sleeve, which was now sodden and sticky with blood, and freed him from his jacket, tearing the rest of it away. The left sleeve was soaked in dark red blood from top to bottom. Blood started dripping onto the floor.
Cut off as much as you like.
Piece by piece, the shirt came away. White-faced, his yellowish body naked to the waist and covered in blood, Alexei willed himself to stay alive, not allowing himself to fall down a second time. He gritted his teeth and felt around on his left shoulder with his right hand.
The bone's not broken, thank God, he said through his teeth. Use a strip of something or a bandage.
I've got bandages, she said faintly but eagerly. She went off somewhere and returned, tearing open a packet.
There's no one else here, she said. I'm by myself.
She sat down by him again. Alexei could see now where he'd been hit. It was a small, not very deep entrance wound, lying close to where the arm joined the body. There was a thin trickle of blood oozing from it.
What about the other side?
He asked abruptly, almost casually, instinctively preserving the breath of life.
There's a wound there as well, she answered with alarm. Tie the tourniquet above it. Yes, there. You'll save the arm.
Never before had he experienced such pain. Green circles, now merging into one, now intermingling with each other, danced in front of his eyes. He bit his lower lip. As she pulled the bandage tight, he helped her with his teeth and his right hand. Together, they bound the arm above the wound in a single, painful, burning knot. The trickle of blood stopped immediately. She now had to move him somehow. He got up onto his knees and put his right arm round her shoulder. She then helped him stand up on his weak, tottering legs, and with her taking the full weight of his body, they managed to get across the room. The low, old-fashioned room was shadowed in twilight. When she had sat him down on something soft and covered in dust, she turned and switched on a lamp with a cherry-colored shade. He could make out a velvet pattern, the edge of a double-breasted frock coat, and a yellowish-gold epaulette in a frame on the wall. Breathing heavily from all the excitement and her exertions, she reached her hands out towards Alexei and said,
I have some brandy. Perhaps you should have some? Some brandy?
Yes, immediately, he answered. And then he collapsed onto his right elbow. The brandy seemed to help a little. At least now he felt that he was no longer at death's door and that he would be able to bear the pain gnawing away at his left shoulder. Kneeling down, the woman bandaged his wounded hand, and then, reaching farther down to his feet, pulled off his felt boots. Then she brought him a pillow and a long Japanese robe embroidered with flowers and smelling sweetly of some age-old perfume.
Lie down, she said.
Obediently, he lay down. She placed the robe on top of him, followed by a blanket, and then stood by a narrow ottoman looking directly at him.
You are a remarkable woman, he said,
adding after a pause,
I'll lie here for a bit, recover my strength, and then I'll get up and go home. I won't trouble you much longer.
His heart was full of anxiety and despair.
What about Yelena? My God, oh my God! And Nikolka? What did he die for? He must be dead.
Without saying a word, She pointed towards the low window, hung with a curtain with pompons. In the distance, he could clearly hear the sound of rifle shots.
"You'd be killed immediately. You can be sure of that," she said.
"In that case, I'm afraid I'll put you in danger. What if they come looking? My revolver, the blood, there in my greatcoat," he said, licking his lips.
His head was spinning lightly from the brandy and loss of blood. The woman's face became anxious, and she thought hard for a moment.
"No," she said decisively. "No. If they'd known where you were, they would have been here a long time ago. It's such a maze around here that nobody would be able to trace where you'd gone. We ran through 3 different gardens. But for now, I have some clearing up to do."
He heard the splash of water, the rustle of some material, and some clattering around in cupboards. When she came back, she had his Browning with her, holding it by the handle with just 2 fingers, as if it were red hot.
"Is it loaded?" she asked.
Freeing his right hand from underneath the blanket, Alexei checked the safety catch.
"Just be careful with it," he replied. "Hold it only by the handle."
When she came back again, she said with some embarrassment,
"Just in case they come, you ought to take off your breeches as well. They'll find you lying there, and I'll tell them that you're my husband, and that you're unwell."
Grimacing and screwing up his eyes, he started to undo the buttons. Without hesitating, she came up to him, knelt down, and pulling off the breeches by the footstraps, took them away somewhere. She wasn't away from him for long. While she was gone, he noticed an archway, indicating that there were essentially 2 rooms. The ceilings were so low that if a tall man were to stand on the tips of his toes, he would be able to touch them with his hand. Beyond the archway, in the depths of the other room, it was dark, but there was the gleaming side of an old polished piano, and something else reflecting the light as well. It seemed to be the flowers of a rubber plant. And there was that glimpse of an epaulette again.
My God, the place was full of antiques.
He was riveted by the sight of the epaulette. The tallow candle in its candlestick gave off a peaceful light. There had been peace at one time, and now that peace was dead. Those years had gone forever. Behind him there were more low windows, and another one to the side. What a strange little house. She was alone. Who was she? She had saved his life. There was no peace any longer. There was still shooting out there. She came in carrying an armful of firewood, which she dropped noisily into one corner of the stove.
"What are you doing? What's that for?" he asked angrily.
"I would have needed a fire in any case," she replied with the hint of a smile. "I heat the place myself."
"Come here," Alexei said quietly. "You know, I haven't thanked you for what you've done. But how can I thank you?"
He reached out and took hold of her fingers. She responded by moving closer to him, and he kissed her slender hand twice. As if relieved of the shadow of anxiety, her face softened and lightened, and at that moment, her eyes looked extraordinarily beautiful.
"If it hadn't been for you," he continued, "they would almost certainly have killed me."
"Yes, of course," she replied. "They would have done. But you killed one of them."
He raised his head.
"I did?" he asked, feeling weak and giddy again.
"Mm-hmm,"
she nodded approvingly and looked at him anxiously and inquiringly.
"Oh, that was so awful. They almost shot me, too."
She shivered.
"How did I kill someone?"
"Well, when they came rushing round the corner, you started to fire, and one of them crashed to the ground. Maybe you just wounded him. In any case, you're a brave man. I thought I would faint. You ran on again for a bit, and then fired again. Then you ran on again. You're clearly a captain, aren't you?"
"How did you know I was an officer? Why did you call out, officer?"
Her eyes shone.
"If someone has a cap badge, then you know these things, I think. Why did you take such a risk?"
"Cap badge? Oh my God, I...
He suddenly remembered the doorbell ringing, the mirror covered in dust.
"I took everything else off, but forgot about the cap badge. I'm not an officer. I'm a military doctor. My name is Alexei Vasilievich Turbin. May I ask your name?"
Yulia Alexandrovna Rice.
Why are you alone?
My husband's not here at the moment,
she answered, sounding a little strained and averting her eyes.
He's gone away, and his mother as well. I'm alone.
It's cold, she added after a pause. I'll make the fire up right away.
Just as the wood started roaring away in the stove, the most violent headache came on. The wound in his arm seemed to have calmed down, but all the pain was now transferring itself to his head, beginning in his left temple, then spreading to the top and the back. A vein above his left eyebrow contracted, and an excruciating pain radiated in all directions.
Yulia Rice knelt by the stove and stoked the fire.
Racked with pain, his eyes closing and opening, he looked across at her, her head flung back, her pale hand shielding it from the heat, and her hair that seemed difficult to define. Ash-colored, flecked with gold, or golden blonde? But her eyes and both eyebrows were definitely as black as coal. Hard to decide whether the slightly irregular profile and aquiline nose were beautiful or not. Impossible to read the expression in her eyes. Fear. Alarm, perhaps. Maybe even some hidden vice. Yes. Some vice, perhaps. Kneeling there like that, bathed in the waves of heat, she seemed wonderfully attractive. His savior. Later that night, when the fire in the stove had long since died down, and when the fever in his arm and hand had begun to flare up again, someone started hammering a red-hot nail into the top of his head and set about destroying his brain. I have a fever, he repeated to himself laconically. Tomorrow I must get up and make my way home, he urged himself. The nail was destroying his brain, so that eventually any thoughts, even of Yelena or Nikolka or home or Petliura, disappeared. He stopped caring about anything. Petura. Petura. All he wanted now was for the pain to stop.
In the early hours of the morning, Yulia Rice came and sat by him. She was wearing a pair of soft, fur-lined slippers. Again, he put his arm round her neck, and although feeling very weak, managed to walk through the two little rooms of the apartment. Just before this, she had gathered her strength and said, Try to get up if you can. Don't pay any attention to me. I'll help you. Then you'll be able to lie down again properly. But if you're not able to, then of course...
No, I can do it, so long as you help me.
Together with her in the lead, they walked as far as the small entrance door of her mysterious little house, and then back again. As he lay down, shivering, his teeth chattering from the cold, he felt the pain in his head taking pity on him and dying down.
I swear, I'll never forget this, what you're doing for me, he said. You must go and sleep now.
Shh, let me stroke your head.
And then the vile, diffuse pain completely flowed out of his head, out of his temples, and into her soft hands, and on through them and her body, down into the floor, covered with a dusty, fluffy carpet, where the pain totally disappeared. Instead of pain, his entire body was now flooded with an even, delicious heat. When his arm grew numb and as heavy as cast iron, he didn't try to move it, but just closed his eyes and surrendered to the heat. He had no idea how long he lay there in that way. Maybe 5 minutes, maybe hours. But in any case, he felt he could lie like that, bathed in fire, for a whole eternity. When he opened his eyes quietly so as not to disturb the person sitting next to him, everything looked as before. The faint, even glow of the lamplight under the cherry-red shade, illuminating the room with its peaceful light, and the profile of the unsleeping woman next to him. Pouting her lips sadly like a child, she was looking out of the window. Swimming in heat, Alexei shifted his position and reached out to her.
Come here. Come closer, he said.
His voice had become dry, weak, and high-pitched. She turned to him with a wary expression in her deeply shadowed eyes. He put his right arm round her neck, drew her to him, and kissed her on the lips. Her lips felt cold and sweet-tasting. She didn't seem surprised, but simply looked into his face even more inquiringly.
Oh, my goodness, you have such a fever, she said. What are we going to do? We need to call a doctor. But I don't know if that's possible.
No, that's not necessary, he said quietly. A doctor won't be necessary. Tomorrow morning I'll get up and go home.
But I'm so worried you'll get much worse, she whispered. Then how will I be able to help you? Is it still bleeding?
She touched his bandaged arm so quietly he couldn't hear her doing so.
No, you don't have to worry. I'll be all right. You go back to bed.
No, I'm staying here, she said, and stroked his hand. Such a fever, she repeated.
Unable to restrain himself, he put his arm round her and drew her to him again. She didn't resist him. He drew her so close to him that she found herself leaning directly over him and then lying right next to him. Through the heat of his own feverish body, he could clearly feel the warmth of her woman's body.
Just keep still. Don't move, she whispered, and I'll stroke your head.
She stretched out by his side, and he could feel her knees touching his. She began to stroke his head from his temple up to his hair and down again. He felt so good that he concentrated all his thoughts on not falling asleep. And so he fell asleep. He slept for a long time, evenly and deeply. When he woke up, he was aware that he was floating along a warm river in a boat, that the pain had gone completely, and that outside the window, the night was gradually getting paler and paler. Everywhere there was total silence, not only inside the little house, but throughout the city. A glassy light began to trickle in through the gaps in the curtains. The woman, warm and sad, was asleep next to Alexei. And once again, he fell asleep. That morning at 9 o'clock, a passing cabbie picked up two fares from an empty Maloprovalnaya street, a pale-looking man wearing dark civilian clothes and a woman. The woman was solicitously supporting the man, who was holding onto her sleeve. She directed the driver to take them to St. Alexei's Hill. There was no traffic on the hill except for a cab outside number 13, from which a strange visitor to the house, carrying a suitcase, a parcel, and a cage, had just emerged.